Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Month of Myers pre-orders are now available through Sunday, September 9th. Five of their shirt designs are up for pre-order, and while these and many others will be released in October, this is the best chance to guarantee in getting one. This includes new designs for the new film, guys. Also coming soon, Teen Wolf Collection, which features all new shirts and enamel pins, as well as the exclusive shirt and enamel pin for the documentary Haunters, which we're all familiar with, as are you, dear listener. Haunters, The Art of the Scare, is now streaming on Netflix. So head on over to www.fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout and get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. So head to www.fright-rags.com now.
This week's Shockwaves is also sponsored by Wellgo USA. Coming soon from Wellgo USA, we have three amazing movies. First up is Gonjim. Based on local legends and stories of people who have visited the real-life abandoned hospital, Gonjim Haunted Asylum follows the crew of horror web show who plan to stream live from inside the asylum, but encounter much more than expected. On digital, Blu-ray, combo, and DVD September 18th. Wellgo USA also has Phantasm in a beautiful 4K scan. The tall man is back with a vengeance. Boy. And they also have, coming soon, Phantasm 3, Lord of the Dead, Phantasm 4, Oblivion, two cult classics in Don Coscarelli's legendary horror franchise, make their standalone Blu-ray debuts September 18th, and they look stunning. Check them out online at www.wellgousa.com.
This week's Shockwave is also sponsored by RLJ Entertainment. Find out what's really going on behind enemy lines in the gruesome thriller Trench 11, out now on DVD, VOD, and digital. A deadly disease created by German forces is on the loose and spreading fast. Will Lieutenant Burton be able to stop the outbreak and end the war? Find out in this dark World War horror. Gruesome Magazine calls it a cinematic thrill ride. Get Trench 11 on Amazon.com now.
Guys, Fangoria is back. Did you know this, Becca?
I did. I'm vaguely familiar.
I did.
Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is coming back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Expect set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Specific content is being kept under wraps for now because Fangoria wants you to experience true analog nostalgia when you open that black poly bag and see what's inside for the very first time. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Be sure to check out their latest release, Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, out now. Head to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria. A subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. That's Fangoria.com. Subscribe now.
And a Phil Noble Jr. nude spread in the middle, apparently. Apparently,
is he dressed as James Bond?
I don't know. Yeah, apparently it is. It says Sean Connery. I'm
Fold
excited.
Out.
That's okay. Apparently what he's going for.
Phil, we can't wait.
I'm in.
Have you guys been listening to the new Blumhouse podcast, Fear Initiative?
I have.
Is it not fun?
It's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. The Blumhouse Podcast Network has just launched an all-new show. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, and Clark Wolf through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week and hear what new horrific quest awaits. Blumhouse's Fear Initiative is now available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Please find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fear Initiative.
Welcome to episode 112. I am your co-host, Ryan Turek. We are down a G,
yeah,
but we've got El Rakane in the house.
I'm here.
We got Dr. Rebecca McKendry in the
house.
Howdy,
how you doing?
We got Ernie over here.
What's up, Ernie?
On the board.
Yeah. What's up from Ernie?
Are you eating Smarties?
Yeah, they're good.
Ew, they taste like baby Tylenol.
I love babies.
So guys, G might be dead. I said Rob G might be dead.
He might be.
If he died, it was of an overdose of goodness, because it looks like he was having the time of his life.
I saw pictures of Rob at Disneyland, and he was wearing ears and almost smiling, guys.
I got to say.
Almost. Yeah, he was wearing Mickey Mouse ears.
I enjoyed seeing him so happy.
It's rare to see him that happy.
No, I didn't say shill. I said shit. I didn't know.
Fucking Disney or shill.
I'm actually curious what Paris Disneyland is like.
I really want to go. Yeah. As soon as he posted pictures, I was like, okay, I really have to experience
this. Jealous of the Jurassic World stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He doesn't go to the dinosaurs.
I love that Rob goes all the way there and then he's like watching Psycho 2 at night. He goes to Psycho and he has to finish the night watching
Nothing
Psycho
changes.
2.
I know we were down an episode last week, but it's with Rob being gone and Becca busy and
We took a trip. We went down. Yeah. We actually recorded a little bonus thing that might eventually see the light of day.
Yeah, Elric and I.
Did
we
I get
went,
the invite for that?
You did.
I did.
You did.
Did I say no?
You were like really busy. With
I said
Slashback.
No too, and at the last minute I came anyway. I actually said no initially.
I know.
Yeah, so it was going to be. We went to Horrible Imaginings Film Festival in Orange County, which is at this wonderful theater.
The Frida is gorgeous.
This beautiful, beautiful theater. They have this murals when you walk in. It's kind of amazing.
Of all your favorite movies.
Of all of our favorite horror films. That's it's really gorgeous. Cool. Like we need to set up screenings there for Shockwaves. It was just a beautiful theater. We're there. Actually, it's a great town. Yeah. So we were there, and originally it was just going to be me because y'all motherfuckers bailed out. And I was like, okay, I'll come up with something good to do. So I had a couple of the cast members from Fear Initiative, and I also had Michael Kennedy from the show we have coming up, Queer Wolf, joining us. And so we all came, and then about 24 hours in advance, Elric was like, oh, guess what? I think I can make it. So then I scrambled.
When I heard his bold horror statements and Becca was going to be down there without us to watch, I was like, all right, somebody's got to rein the shit in. I'm going.
Send my police rolling.
I think he did say something that was fairly cray.
No.
I've actually forgotten half of the things
How
we talked about. But
I said... I thought that In the Mouth of Madness was one of the best films of the 90s.
She if said not, it was better than The Thing.
No, I said it was as good as The Thing.
That's still a bold horror statement.
No.
That is bold. I like that movie a lot, but to compare anything to The Thing is getting a little uppity.
You know what I was super bummed about?
I think it's
about?
Good.
Anyway, we might hear that episode.
Yeah, it'll be up in a couple of weeks. It was a good one.
So while you guys were doing that, I just want to throw a little plug to Slashback Video, which kicks off tomorrow. You're listening to this on Friday. At the Mystic Museum, Saturday night, 8 o'clock, we're going to have our opening reception. If you can't make it, the gallery will be open through December.
Nice.
We are in a much larger space, as I saw last night, as we were moving it all in. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy how big it is.
How does this feel different than the last time?
It's going to – visually, you'll notice there's a lot more space. There's a lot more tapes. It's just visually stimulating on a – larger level than it was last year.
Okay.
And we've got video games. We've got a kids section now.
Oh, wow.
But the funny thing is I'm putting up the kids section. I'm like, oh, cool. Look at all these great kids movies. And then one rack below it, it's like Three on a Meat Hook. Not
totally
Dawn of the
true.
Dead, which is, you know, very much like a video store where you're just kind of watching you're seeing children's stuff. And then like one aisle away is just the most perverse, vile, gory covers.
I think if you guys do it again, you need to create a little room with a little curtain just so it's
just
there
so
in
it's
the back.
There.
An actual curtain. Check it out. Admission's $10. Please go support and it'll keep Slashback going. It's going to be a pretty cool thing. Ciara and the Mystic Museum partners, Kiko and Eric, we're all now like in this together.
That's awesome.
It's going to be super cool, and we've got some cool plans for it.
You mentioned Kinder Trauma and video games. So I have to say, while we were at Horrible Imaginings, there was this bar like a block away from the festival that we went to with Josh Forbes, and it was like a barcade where it's got all these old school video games. And we walk in, and next to the ATM machine is this pinball machine that had haunted me my entire childhood called Funhouse.
I took a video of it. It's creepy.
Yeah. It's like this marionette clown head that comes awake and talks to you and is like, welcome to the fun house. And then it plays this like calliope music. Like it's just, it's maddening.
I'll post it to our Shockwaves Instagram so people can see this creepiness.
I had to play it because, I mean, they had the Addams Family game, and they had the Eddie Iron Maiden pinball and all of these really cool pinball machines. But that one, it was the fun house one that I was like, oh my God. And then we played played House of the Dead too.
Yeah.
Nice.
Which was pretty cool. Yeah.
That's always a good
yeah,
one.
We had to save G because you spend the whole game saving G.
I kept thinking of Rob. We were saving G. But clearly we didn't do a good job because
yeah,
he's
not
here.
No, he's not here.
One last plug. We got a plug because it's our last week before Miskatonic. So Miskatonic Institute of Horror Studies is opening in LA. And so it's been in London. It's been in New York. The first one, and the reason why I want to make sure we get people there is because we have, you know, celebrity guests. The great Don Coscarelli, who has been on our show before and was one of my favorite episodes in terms of telling a story, has a new book called True Indie, Life and Death in Filmmaking, which this is technically the launch of his entire book tour. So this might actually be the first chance, don't quote me on it, but I think it's the first place you can even get his book before he starts his tour. So he's going to do a career chat that will be at least 2 hours long. So it's like a full going into his career. Friend of the show, Jared Rivett's going to host the interview and we're going to be there. So if you're a Phantasm Coscarelli Beastmaster fan, I would definitely recommend trying to go. The links are up. If you just look up Miskatonic, tickets are available. But
Thursday the 13th. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. And the building that we're doing it in, the location is absolutely incredible. This amazing space in Silver Lake. The philosophy.
School of Philosophical Research, I think. I'm probably butchering it.
It's really Lovecraftian.
Yeah, it's very Lovecraftian.
Really crazy,
library.
Cool library.
But this is a launch. Like, we're launching with, obviously an event about his career and life. But after this month, we'll be getting to these actual horror lectures.
Hey, Kane, who's the next horror lecture?
The first one is Aquatic Horror with none other than Dr. Rebecca McHenry.
Sweet.
Yeah.
And then we move into some pretty interesting topics. So, you know, hopefully, this is the kind of thing that if it doesn't go, this is definitely a test run. And if these four classes don't fly in LA, because you just never know what each city's going to, how they're going to react, then it probably won't happen again. So hopefully, like all things, like Slashback, you come out and check it out.
Yeah.
All right, guys, what have you seen?
Well, I'm going to start with the good stuff because then I saw two like batshit crazy, like I don't know what to do with them. So I watched Ghoul on Netflix.
Thank you, Becca.
It's really good.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did enjoy this.
Who recommended it to you?
Actually, Elric did because I was bitching about the other two films.
She was like, I'm watching some crap. And I'm like, you should check out Ghoul. I heard it's good. And I haven't even seen it.
I didn't even watch it. But I watched two films that back to back that I was like, oh my God, these are a little rough. And then he was like, so you should check out Ghoul on that.
Did you know that?
No! Can I say that on air?
Yeah.
You're the fucking executive producer. Ryan literally just sent me a note that says, I'm the executive producer.
Jason and I executive produce Ghoul.
It's not a Blumhouse project, though.
Yes, it is.
It doesn't have the logo up at the front.
Oh, that's interesting. Good to know. No. There's a
lawsuit.
No, it is. It is.
It's really fucking good. Oh my gosh. I had no idea.
It's our first foray. When we announced the Indian Initiative, which was to produce like a number of horror films specifically in India, Ghoul was the first one that got the green light. Like, they had submitted a bunch of stuff to me and I looked at it and nothing seemed like the right fit, but our partners over at Phantom in India, they said, you guys really need to check out Ghoul. I read Ghoul and I was like, yep, that's a good one.
Yeah,
I like that.
It was really good.
I can't go on with this anyway. Just for the listeners, they would practice this for the last 5 minutes. This is all bullshit.
Just to plug it.
Like, Becca knew he did it.
This
was all a big Blumhouse piece. Just part of our promotion.
No, seriously. I had no idea. Yeah. And I watched all three episodes and did not catch that it was Blumhouse affiliated. Yes. So that's really, really cool.
I like Sharper Objects. What do I get? Do I get a hug?
Yeah, he's been watching Sharper Objects. So
great ending, by the way.
So yeah, this is directed by a guy named Patrick Graham. It is a 3-part miniseries on Netflix right now. I feel really stupid explaining all this to Ryan because apparently he executive produced it.
Go on.
So it's set in this totalitarian future where there's definitely two warring parties in India, and the reigning military is trying to cleanse society. So they're like taking down the academics and trying to make sure that no one's talking, you know, crazy tots. It's very kind of 1984. And this one female soldier who's kind of in training as an interrogator turns in her own father, as he's a professor, and she turns him in for teaching stuff that's not ordained by the military, by the government. And as a reward for turning in her own father, which is a really shitty thing to do, and they established that from the beginning, she gets promoted into this major interrogation system, into this major prison. And the scenes of like the prison and the interrogation and the torture itself was some of the most horrific part. There's literally a scene where she walks into a room and somebody's swabbing up the blood and you don't even know what happened. It's just like, holy shit. And as they start interrogating this one prisoner that they believe to be this like crazy connected terrorist, as they begin interrogating him, you realize that there's something else going on. He seems to know a lot about them, a lot of personal stuff. And then you kind of are getting this kind of backstory of this cult at the same time. But yeah, it's basically built out of the interrogations, and you learn the story through that. So it's really innovative. I loved the setting. It's very small and self-contained, and it feels very claustrophobic, but that's part of the charm.
Yeah.
And yeah, so cool. It's quite good.
Cool, cool, cool.
Yeah. Thanks. So that's cool on Netflix.
Patrick was a cool guy to work with, and he just understood what it needed to be. It was interesting because he's not from India. Mm-hmm. He's actually British.
Yeah, I looked it up.
Yeah,
because, he'd done something else.
He had done a lot of commercials and stuff like that. And that was like the concern. It was like, oh, okay. Can he actually direct down there? But he understood. He was fluent in Hindi, and he just knew how to control the set and took care of everything. And Phantom was very easygoing with him. And
lead actress fucking killed it. Oh, she's like great. She's
really cool. But it was just cool to watch the process. There was a point when once it segued over to Netflix that I was a little hands off. But as through the development and through the shooting and then through multiple cuts of the film, I was definitely there to like give notes and stuff like that.
And I liked how it functioned as a miniseries. Like, I think if it had been like a full film, I would have been a little taxed by it because it is so claustrophobic. I liked that it was broken up because it felt a little bit freer. Yeah, they're heavy. They're real heavy. Yeah, so being able to separate.
Yeah, what I always gravitated to is just like the kind of thing like nature of who's who, you know?
Yeah.
So it's cool.
Yeah, it's really good.
Awesome.
You know what I saw? I saw
Sharp Objects.
which is a great ending if you haven't seen it yet.
I watched it too.
I very much enjoyed where it went to. I hadn't watched Salem's Lot in about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And the Blu-ray was sitting in my thing, and I always liked it. But F This Movie, Patrick Bromley was doing an all-day tribute to Toby Hooper, and he was Skyping in, like, you know, Mick Garrison, all sorts of people throughout the day, and he asked me and Brian to pick a movie to talk about for an hour. Yeah. So we were in one of the first spots, and you can listen to that on F This Movie. And we just kind of dive into Salem's Lot. I thought it was great. You know, I love the feeling of the town in that. It's one of the things that I feel Castle Rock gets close to but hasn't quite nailed yet is just that kind of the sporadic nature and kind of vibe of what the town feels like in Salem's Lot is just maybe the closest to what I want Castle Rock to feel like in a King world. But I think it's a really great and obviously all the kinder traumas beautifully intact, so you can check that out. But on the Castle Rock front, I did want to mention that if you are on the fence on the series, I know a couple of people watched the first three and then didn't continue. The Sissy Spacek episode is one of the best episodes of television ever. Yeah. Because it also might be a bit of a lesson to the show itself that the direction of single character focus might really help them, because sometimes they are jumping from character to character, introducing a lot of people.
That's one of the things I found most frustrating.
That's
and
what I mean,
I stopped after the third episode because it felt like the same thing that True Detective did, where the first season I was totally engaged because I was engaged with the two detectives, and then the second season I was like, there's like six people and I can keep up, but I'm not really engaged with any of them.
Like Lost did that. It kept adding character, but at a certain point gave you deepening of characters, flashbacks and stuff. And I like the show a lot. Like, I'm into it. It's been at a point I was like, oh yeah, I'm watching it for the story now. But this episode, it is just focused on Spacek, and she is suffering from medical illness that is causing her to she's got Alzheimer's and her time is getting confused and the way she treats time, and so they treat the editing and direction of the story itself elliptically, and it creates a really just beautiful piece of filmmaking and a brilliant performance by her. It's the kind of thing that could get someone an Emmy for one episode. Anyway, it was really cool to see that. So those two were my little King world for the week.
Salem's Lot is like a great security blanket.
Oh, so good. And it's nice and long.
It's very atmospheric. You kind of settle into the characters.
Yeah, James Mason's great.
Yeah.
You
know,
I will say, the one part that shocked me, because Barlow doesn't shock me anymore, the part that I had forgotten is when James Mason picks the guy up.
Oh, yeah.
Because you forget he has like super strength because we think he's a normal guy. That part actually kind of fucked me up. I was like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. I had fun watching that.
Cool. I saw a film called Slaughterhouse Rock.
Oh, is that the werewolf one?
It's not a werewolf. It looks like a werewolf.
It's that cover that we've all seen.
Okay, yeah, I remember the cover.
Basically, you've got Alcatraz at the bottom, and then you've got this dude that's kind of got werewolf-like features as if he's going through a transformation, but he's really not. He's just a demon. But follow me with this one. So you've got...
Is this Italian or something?
No, okay. No, it's very much American. It was shot on Alcatraz.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Is this, like, I always thought this was part of the heavy metal grouping that I'd never seen. It's not.
No,
okay.
No, it's, and here's my naivete. You know, I was like, oh, this is going to be a cool rock and roll horror movie.
Yeah.
No, Slaughterhouse Rock, the rock refers to Alcatraz.
Oh, yes. But he looks like such a headbanger on the cover.
I know, there's hair involved.
Yes.
And there are, but the funny thing is, too, is they refer to a group of rockers who killed themselves on Alcatraz in the first 20 minutes. So I'm like, here comes the heavy metal. Yeah. And yet there is nothing. Huh. But basically, it's about this guy who lives with two other dudes. They're like college age dudes. And our lead character has very bizarre dreams that are all related to Alcatraz. And he feels like these dreams are a kind of phone call to him to go and be part of some mission or something like that. He feels he's like getting a call for help, but he doesn't know from who. He doesn't know why.
Like a vision?
Like dreamlike visions and stuff like that. Yeah. And so all of his goofball friends are like, oh, whatever, man. It's just you. Until these dreams start to take a kind of much more tangible hold of him in a very Nightmare on Elm Street sort of way. So they hear him screaming from the bedroom. They open up the door, and there he is levitating on a column of light. And he's like screaming, and they're like, oh, my God, shit's getting real. And then the column of light disappears, and he falls on a bed. And he's like, see, guys, I told you my dreams are weird. And then he reaches out to his teacher, his like really sexy looking teacher who is complete. Oh, there's a lot of weird casting choices in this, but she reaches out to him. She's like, I'm a paranormal investigator. I can help you. I know what these dreams are. It's all connected to this book that was discovered in Alcatraz, and Alcatraz has this very lengthy history that goes back centuries, and it deals with dark mojo and all that stuff. So we got to go there and figure out what's up. So the teacher, the college dude, his buddies, and his girlfriend all go to Alcatraz. They get on a boat. They get on a friend's boat in the middle of the night. Just take a little jaunt over to Alcatraz.
Just a little trip to college trip to Alcatraz.
Yeah, just to go to Alcatraz. And then they kind of dig into Alcatraz's deep history of bad luck and murder and mayhem. And along the way, our main character meets a very friendly ghost who kind of resembles Susie from Susie and the Banshees, maybe a little bit. She's definitely got that style. And
he doesn't know it's a ghost. He has no idea.
No, he knows it's a ghost. Oh, yeah. And she's like, I'm the one who's been calling you. I accidentally set this evil loose on Alcatraz. I need you to help me put it back in its little urn or jar or whatever. What happens then is that the evil on the island begins to possess all of his friends in very Night of the Demons-like fashion. Yeah. And then one by one, they start to die. They then become ghosts themselves and begin to haunt their friend and try to help him defeat the evil. It's a very, very complex film, Elric.
I'm really confused already.
The cover doesn't look complex.
No, that's the thing. It just looks like a good time, right?
Yeah.
And what happens?
Do you have that cover at Slash Track?
We do.
Of course you do.
As you should.
So what we have here is a film that is basically a late 80s entry into the kind of Evil Dead, Night of the Demon-esque possession story, but winds up being so exposition heavy that it really bogs down a lot of the fun.
Yeah.
There's some really interesting directorial choices too. There's a scene where our character and his girlfriend are having dinner, and they're like, okay, we're going to go to dinner. And then we cut to the restaurant, and there's this long tracking shot through the restaurant, and the camera turns.
I've seen a lot of Goodfellas.
Yeah. Turning from, well, at least in Goodfellas, you're following the protagonist. Yeah. Here, you're not following anything at all. You're just going through the restaurant, and you're kind of, the camera turns and focuses on one couple and then another table. And you're like, oh, here we go. We're gonna see them. Nope, not them. And then we start to hear their conversation, and you're like, oh, here, the camera's turning. We're going to find our main characters. Nope, that's not them. And it goes around in a U-shape until we come to the very end of the U-shape, and we find our two characters.
They only had a dolly for a day, so they really had to put it to good use.
Because we can.
What the fuck?
Could it have been the ghost point of view? Could the ghost have just been walking?
No.
Can we try to justify this for the guy?
No, not at all. But the funny thing is The funny thing is that when they show one of the couples, it was actually somebody I know.
Oh.
It was a Blumhouser.
Oh,
it's a stout.
Wow.
One of our first ADs / line producers. And I had to text him. I was like, dude, I just saw you at Slaughterhouse Rock. Huh. And he goes, only you would know that, Turek. He's like, I've never had anybody approach me.
That's pretty funny.
Oh, anyways, it's a, you know, if you're a completist that needs to see, you know, kind of everything under the sun that's remotely 80s horror, I would definitely check it out. There is some, I think with friends, you can have a little bit of fun with it, but it does get a little sluggish towards the end. And it is kind of just, it's kind of a kitchen sink movie.
Great cover, though.
Great cover. Yeah.
Looks like not that a Italian guy, Enzio Schiotti or whatever. It looks like one of his.
Yeah,
which always makes you want to watch
one. This one was directed by Dimitri Logothetis.
Huh. Sounds
who did a lot. Yeah, he sounds Greek. He's done a lot of the current Kickboxer movies, Kickboxer Vengeance and Kickboxer Retaliation.
So he's still working.
Still working.
Nice.
Well, I'll continue with another kitchen sink movie. So this one is Miss Leslie's Dolls from 1973. And this is an exploitation film that I had never heard of. And it's considered to be a lost exploitation film. And they found a copy, and Network Releasing is putting it out. And this is from the director who did Savages from Hell and Shantytramp, both of which I'd seen. So, yeah.
Of course you did.
I have great viewing lexicon, guys. So anyway, this is kind of an old dark house setup where a professor and three of her college students are out. There's this crazy ass storm. They have to find a place to stay for the night. So they litter, pull over and find the weirdo mansion to stay in. They get there and it is a woman, question mark. who is holding a cat and keeps these giant life-size dolls and talks about her dead sister and her dead mother. And you get that there's some weird shit going on. And then everyone goes to bed like you do. And then it proceeds to a lot of bed swapping. So we get some sex. There's some lesbianism. There's some nudity because it's an exploitation film. Things have to get absolute crazy. And then boom, at the end, you find out Miss Leslie's a man. And that was the big twist. But she has 5 o'clock shadow from the get-go. So I assumed that that was like a thing from the get-go, which is why I have no problems telling the twist.
Spoil this whole story?
No, because seriously, like every single review I read online was like, but you know it's a man in the first 5 minutes, and that's like the big twist. Okay. It's definitely a kitchen sink movie. Like, I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad I have completed this part of my life.
The trilogy. You've done the trilogy.
I have now completed it. But that said, I mean, I think this could, like Turex, I think this could be fun with the right group of people because it is so batshit crazy in the acting. There's parts of it that you're just like, oh my God, that was hilarious. That line was amazing. But I have to say, for a movie about a mansion-owning man dressed as a woman carrying around a cat with life-size dolls that may or may not actually be people, it was a little dry.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's Miss Leslie's Dolls.
It's got all the hallmarks, though.
I know, right? You would really expect it to be just crazy. And it is, I mean, because the acting is bad and some of the shots, you know, like it's just, it's definitely a completist movie.
It's funny because we, you know, our whole task is, you know, with this podcast is to introduce you to new films that you may never seen.
Mm-hmm.
Not new contemporary films, but even older films.
Yes.
And you know, doing the whole Slashback thing, I would have seen Slaughterhouse Rock if I didn't just suddenly own it on VHS. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting to try to, I don't like to bag on everything, but I do feel it's our responsibility to go, listen, manage your expectations. Slaughterhouse Rock is not going to rock your pants off. You might have some enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, because we spend a lot of time reclaiming gems, but the fact is there's a reason some of them never made the leap to DVD or Blu-ray.
And I mean, and this is a seedy, low budget, not the greatest made exploitation film to begin with. Yeah. And so to then say on top of it, and the plot's a little dry too.
Well, if we didn't love it, we wouldn't waste our time watching them.
I know. I still watched the whole movie for Miss Leslie's Dolls. Yeah. And then at the end went, that was a little dry. But that said, if you are an exploitation or grindhouse completionist, it definitely hits all the earmarks of exploitation. And you definitely should check it out to just complete your lexicon.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's coming soon from Network Releasing.
What's it called again?
Miss Leslie's Dolls.
I think I've got a Turk pick. He might have already seen this one.
Please.
But would you want to see a movie with a gun-toting Michael Rooker dressed as a priest, Tony Todd basically playing Captain Ron against as they battle a shadow monster from an MVD title from about 91.
Oh my God, what movie
what is
that?
This movie is called Shadow Builder, but not just Shadow Builder. Bram Stoker's Shadow Builder.
Do you know this movie?
I do. I saw it when it first came out.
As soon as Rooker entered wearing a priest outfit, holding a gun, and like bodies bleeding in a bad Hellraiser sequel, I instantly thought of you. Yes. I was like, this is a Turing watching this movie somewhere
I'm
in the world.
I'm adding this to my list right now.
I can give you my my copy from MVD.
Thank you.
But that doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. It's just not necessarily a keeper for me. But man, the shadow monster itself, which is basically, you know, the devil. In this film is a little cheesy. The effect obviously is very CGI, but the actual build-up's pretty fun. But Tony Todd is totally ridiculous. I love Tony Todd, but he is dressed as Captain Ron and he has an eye patch, and I don't know if he's a homeless guy or if he, I mean, and everything's a one-liner with him. It is very strange. Yeah. I could not even remember really recount the plot now. It's kind of like,
I know the cover and I know the font that Shadow Builder is written in.
Well, this,
and it feels like a
Hellraiser.
Well, that's
on the cover
crazy.
Is fucking amazing.
MVD delivered a pretty nice cover there. It definitely feels like the fifth Hellraiser film. It feels like something in that world to an extent, but it has got some fun kills and Rooker's fun. I mean, this is, you know, Rooker's still, I think, in top mode here, and it's fun to see him where he could be a good guy, could be a bad guy. I feel like now he always is just pegged as a bad dude.
Well, this was one of those lenticular covers, the VHS. That's why I remember that. It's one that moves.
Oh, now I remember. Yeah. That I remember.
The one thing I didn't think about is the Bram Stoker's. Like, after watching it, like, I'd have to read to know how Bram Stoker is really, like, you know, what element of his story was used for this, because it's pretty contemporary otherwise. So anyway, that was fun, kind of a bonkers movie, but you know what, a movie that's really good,
yes please,
that a lot of people have been talking about, and I hadn't seen it till now, but I heard the sound mix happening a lot while we recorded the show. Upgrade is like giving me the guest vibes of the year. Like, I loved when The Guest came out, that was like my little underdog of the year, where I was like, I love this movie.
Right.
Upgrade delivered the same thing for me this year. I know Brian, Sarah, other friends of mine had been raving about it, and I was like, all right, yeah, I'll get to it. And I thought it was just so much fun. And it's so funny. And that's, I think, the difference. Like, when it's just doing the sci-fi stuff, I'm like, yeah, this is good. But it's when the lead actor is more or less taken over and he has this comic expression on his face as his body acts without him, that I'm just dying. And I thought it was great. So this is a real gem. If you're on the fence about seeing this one, it is a Blumhouse title, you know, obviously, but it's really fucking good. And Lee, like, I thought Lee did a competent job on Insidious 3 as a director. Like, it has some really good moments, but I didn't really think the movie worked. This is like a total game changer to me about him as a talent, as a director.
Oh, yeah.
It's like huge.
No, I mean, like, he demonstrated he's got the action chops. He's got the comedy chops.
Comedy,
obviously.
We knew he would have.
Yeah, we knew that. Yeah, it's
a great movie.
It was one of those movies that was already kind of in the works, like at the tail end of development when I first got here, and it was just a script that we really loved. And
was that his original script?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. And Bea, my colleague and the other VP / exec here, she went to set in Australia, and she that was one of her babies that she oversaw, and you know, I wasn't watching too closely what was going on. I just wanted to kind of see it fresh. When that first cut came in, and I was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. And yeah, you're right. It's all the Logan Marshall Green's performance when Stem takes over. There's just an authenticity. You believe that he's actually being controlled by this other entity.
Yeah.
You know,
it's and really
the voice
well
of Stem is cool. Yeah. Uh-huh. The music is beautiful and just really well done. Yeah.
And it's simple and fun. And the other thing, like, what I love about some of these directors getting a chance to do things like sci-fi is they bring in a little bit, like, same with S. Craig Zahler.
Yeah.
They bring a little gore into it because they're horror people, but they bring it into a genre that's not horror, and I love it. So when the first kind of the mouth slashing kill happens in this movie, it's fucking rad. And you're like, oh, yeah, fuck yeah. And if fans of things like RoboCop and, you know, great movies like that, I think you'll get a kick out of it. But I mean The Guest in the way that it's a small film, clearly a lower budget film that's then being pushed to look like much bigger than it is.
Yeah. And it's a bigger concept.
Yeah, big concept. Yeah. High concept for sure. Really, really.
And what they pulled off. And what they pulled off in terms of effects and scope for something that's set 5 minutes into the future.
Yeah,
it's really impressive.
Now, this is definitely going to be one of the year's best, I think. I don't know if it'll be on my horror list, but it'll be on my favorite films list because it's much more of a, you know, it's a mixed genre film.
Yeah.
It's awesome either way.
Watched a bunch of stuff over the long weekend. I watched Hocus Pocus because Sierra wanted to watch Hocus Pocus.
I love
Pocus.
That movie.
Yeah, I was never like a huge Hocus Pocus fan. This time I appreciated it a little bit more, and it was just because it came after me. Like, it came after my generation. And, you know, I had other Halloween favorites to go to. And Hocus Pocus, it was just like, it seemed really sweet and saccharine and whatever. But it's an enjoyable, fun movie. My takeaway from Hocus Pocus on this new round was just how colorful it is.
Mm-hmm.
The color palette is just really beautiful and vivid. There's just like these really bright greens and purples, and you should rewatch.
Yeah, I haven't seen it since
the
photography.
No, it's fun.
The cinematography
is really
fun. Beautiful, and that's what I feel is like lacking from horror movies sometimes. Not in the independent film, we're trying to cover, you know, bad writing or bad acting with cinematography with these like really big Argento-esque colors. But just in the very fun, we've got a lot of production design and atmosphere to display. You know, there's a great scene when he initially lights the Virgin's candle, and all of a sudden this green light comes blasting through the floorboards. And I was like, yeah, man, this is really cool.
It's like Bram Stoker's Dracula has that. Like, that's what was so great about it. It's like so lush.
It's very lush. And that's what I kind of gravitate to on the new Goosebumps movies, because they kind of carry that torch. I really like the first Goosebumps film, just because it's just like, it's a big cartoon on display. And I'm not talking about the CGI, but it's just got that vivid imagery.
Yeah.
It's scope. And also it just kind of has that almost – that weird Creepshow patina to it. You know?
And I'm so excited about House with the Clock in its walls.
Yeah,
I loved that book when I was a kid. I'm super excited to see the movie.
That's so funny. I saw the poster for that and I went, that looks so much like a Goosebumps sequel, but I guess it's not because it's called the House of the Clock. I literally went through my head.
That's the one thing. Weird to see those two posters side by side.
Yeah, the House of the Clock in its walls has been around for a long time. Like that book had been around for a long time when I was a kid.
But that's Jack Black as well, right?
Yeah, because they're trying to play off the Goosebumps. But two other kids, kind of, I'll call them kids-ish horror movies that I'll horror movie light that I'll recommend for Halloween. Halloween Town, which was part of why I named Marnie, because the main character in it's named Marnie. And I was it's just a super fun kids movie. And then a couple of years ago, Joe Dante did this movie, which I believe is streaming on Netflix right now, called The Hole.
That's 3D.
Yeah, and was it 3D?
It was 3D, yeah.
Really cool concept about just a two brothers who move into a new house, and they find this kind of hole in the basement, and it's kind of like a sub-basement, and weird shit starts coming out of it. And it's just really kind of preteen appropriate. But I watched it just 2 years ago and was like, this movie's great. Like, it actually has some really good scares in it.
Did we just skip September? You guys are now recommending October movies.
I know.
What just happened,
guys? We literally
excited.
Spent
I'm
September
so ready.
1st putting up Limax Halloween.
We have a ton of
stuff.
I have the motorcycle shop. I have the motorcycle shop. I have the movie theater. I have dance hall. You will not buy my movie theater.
God damn it.
It's so cool because that one, it actually projects on the ceiling. It's so cool. And
really
it plays this awesome matinee music.
We always joke that, I'm from Connecticut, and I always joke that I've got like this kind of inner grandmother that loves this kind of shit inside me. And it's like every time I go to Michael's, I'm like, ooh, the Limax collection. And I'm like pushing grannies out of the way, just get my like evil twins to put next to my my haunted house or whatever. I love that shit.
Oh, I have the little trees that go with it. I have the pets collection where all the pets have costumes on. I am totally lame like that.
Yeah.
But if you asked me to put up Christmas Village, I'd be like, oh, fuck no.
No,
I do have the Nightmare
Secret
Before Christmas Village.
I'm jealous. The secret to the Christmas Village is to take some of the roads and incorporate them into the Halloween Village.
Okay, so we're going to do a hobby
a
crossover episode where we talk about.
Right.
Now, Jeff, you bought
fucking
the styrofoam platforms for your Limax villages yet? Okay, we
go
have
on my
this.
Instagram. You'll get to see
because I've got mine flocked with the dead grass, and then I've got the fake trees to go around.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
go on. I did a very nice tracking shot of my village.
Okay.
Beyond Hocus Pocus, what I do when speaking of other colorful films, we revisited Bride of Chucky.
Nice.
Ronnie Yu's film. That movie is way ahead of its time in terms of cleverness. No, Elric, it's really funny.
I think it's a lot
of fun. In terms of Chucky, I mean, like, it came out in the late 90s. It came out in the wake of the Scream boom. We were getting a lot of films like that. So you could see the kind of influence of incorporating teenage leads, but everything that was going on with, you know, the kind of the writing of Chucky and pushing him into new territory. I applaud. And I, you know, and hats off to Don Mancini for not just giving us a typical slasher film, but something that's just like,
that's pretty bonkers.
That's commenting on gender politics and the gender war and all this kind of fun stuff, all these like gender things that are going on, and just like putting also a spotlight on Chucky, what a pain in the ass and what an asshole kids Chucky are, is.
Oh
no,
my God.
No, no, no. Chucky's
oh,
like,
but he's terrible.
Chucky is like the Me Too movement. Chucky is dead, man. Yeah. It's just like, it's
and
hilarious.
I always liked that one because Tiffany is a killer. And you rarely see female killers. Yeah. And not only that, she's like a strong ass woman to begin with. So she's just fucking amazing to begin with. So when I see females dressing up like her, I'm like, yeah, I would cosplay as Tiffany in a heartbeat.
Well, it's our Halloween inspiration.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. And I will say, quick plug, our new show that is launching on the Blumhouse Network in just a couple of weeks, Attack of the Queer Wolf, Don Mancini is the first guest.
Sweet.
So yeah.
I do awesome. Like all the stuff with them. The Chucky and her, I think, is all great. It's the mixture of humans and some of the comedy for me, but hey, you know, it's much better than Seed. I'll take it any day over Seed, Chucky.
I don't mind Seed.
Oh man, Seed is a rough watch, I gotta say. I struggled to get through it. Becca's turn.
So this one, and this is another completionist movie, Brian Usna's Beneath Still Waters.
I remember the cover, but I don't think I ever saw it.
This was like during his Spanish production.
Spanish production years.
He had a long period doing that.
So because I'm doing the Miskatonic lecture in October on aquatic horrors, I've been trying to make sure that I've seen all of the aquatic horrors that I can possibly get my hands on. And I'd owned this one for a while, but I'd never watched it because the cover is a girl in a bikini staring at a skull in the water. And it wasn't that alluring for me, so I never watched it. It's not that good. It's, you know, there's parts
Usna
of it.
Directed it or produced
Usna directed it.
Oh, okay.
And, and even he didn't seem to like it when I was watching some of the stuff and the interviews and things like that. So it's based on a novel, and, the whole concept of it is really cool. Like, I wanted it to be, bigger than it turned out to be. So the whole concept is that there's this tiny town, and, in the basement of one of the buildings, there's all of these people who are following Aleister Crowley, and they're worshiping Satan, and they have trapped all of these people that they plan to sacrifice. But then they find out that the town is about to be flooded because they're turning it into a quarry. And so they just leave everybody in these cages and they flood the whole town. And so all of these people who were there for like satanic sacrifices and everything die when they flood the town.
Okay.
And so then now, years later, this girl whose mother lived in this town comes to swim in the lake. And then some zombies come out.
Oh, cool.
And I really, really, really wanted it to be more than that. I really wanted it to be more than just like, and now some scary shit happens.
Right.
You know, and it went from crazy high concept setup with the flooding and the quarry and the satanic cult to group of teens in bikinis get stalked at a summer lake. And that's kind of where it went. So I wanted more, but the setup was cool.
Interesting.
So yeah, I'm not sure if I would call it aquatic horror aside from the fact that there happens to be water and bikinis and some dead people in the water.
Aquatic horror has to be something from underneath, right? Something that lives below.
Well, I think of aquatic horror as it has to have some type of, it has to primarily be in the water, and that it has to, I would say, be kind of aquatic in nature. But then again, I take that back because I think like the movie Below, like the submarine movie Below, I consider that aquatic horror.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know.
The setting is underwater, though.
But, I wouldn't consider anything Camp Crystal Lakey to be, even though that Jason's in the water.
Wait, Below is aquatic horror?
I consider Below to be aquatic horror. Yeah, the submarine, like the World War movie. Yeah.
Aronofsky, wrote that, I think.
Yeah, because the whole thing, it's like submarine and...
Zach Galifianakis.
And Bruce Greenwood.
Zach Galifianakis is really good in it. Yeah. I definitely consider that to be aquatic horror. I will say fringy.
I'm
but
going
I
to sit
it.
In on your panel so I can see what the delineation is.
It's
between.
On the 24th of October.
There better be some shockwaves mentioned.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
What do you got?
To end, a nice little story. I finally got to... I put this on the social media, but you never know who's listening. King Cohen, I finally got to see the documentary.
Oh, cool.
Which has a little bit of Turk in it. Mm. But this was interesting. It was the day of the third anniversary of Jump Cut closing. I posted that morning. I went to the end of the day for some reason. I thought, you know, I haven't seen King Kong yet. I'm sure it's great. Started watching it, and I had no – I knew we Jump Cut was mentioned. I didn't realize the apex of the emotional arc of the story ends at Jump Cut.
Jump Cut. Yes. Ryan so and me, I told you this.
No one said that.
I swear to God.
Well, I mean, it was a long time ago when you guys saw it. And so I'm sitting there watching this documentary, and then suddenly I'm in soft focus standing next to Larry Cohen as he's saying, oh, this is, you know, really, really just a great feeling that people are getting to hear the script. And I was just sitting there going, oh, man, this is like a perfect, nice end to that loop.
Yeah.
To know that like something you did had an impact on someone, no matter how insignificant, and in the context of the documentary, felt really good. And it's also just a great fucking film about him, and I love his work, and he's such a unique talent, especially as a writer. He can just write himself out of any situation. Mm-hmm. That's why I like his work so much. So it was really fun. I would highly recommend you see it, but it is pretty cool to see them doing this reading of, what was it called, Movie House or something? It was like one of his scripts that never got made.
That was so cool.
Yeah, it's
was
really good
really
script.
Meta,
it's fun.
I remember.
Yeah,
it was
super meta.
You're watching a movie on, not unangst like. Was it Angst that did that? Where you're watching a movie on Anguish.
Yeah.
So it was the same kind of setup, but I remember it going in cool places.
Yeah, it was interesting. You could see why it wasn't made, but then that's the thing about his ideas. The ideas are always big, and sometimes they can get adapted well. And what was cool to see about his career was how he just, I didn't realize how big he was in TV. I think our generation doesn't. Our generation, he starts making movies with It's Alive. But this is a guy who had made like, you know, 8 years of major television branded, being huge to a generation before us. And then he just got sick of seeing people adapt his stuff badly. And he was like, I want to control everything. So he did. Anyway, super cool to see that twist. And I think people really enjoy the documentary, even though they didn't go into It's Alive 3, Island of It's Alive. I wanted some of that. Maybe it's on the extra features. Maybe they go all the way. You know, but
where is that available now?
That was just streaming on Amazon. I think I'd still pay for it. It was still
got it.
But you know, well worth it. And the best stuff is him and Fred Williamson telling stories, and Larry Cohen will be like, "Yeah, Fred wouldn't jump out of the taxi, so I'd have to do it first." And then Fred goes, "If he said that, he's a fucking liar.
Yeah.
You think he could jump out?" And you could just tell they really had total alternate truths. I loved it. I was like, "That's a good documentary that does that."
So it is
Michael
fun.
Moriarty was really fun when Ryan and I saw it in we. Saw that at Fantasia.
You're up in Canada, I remember.
Yeah, yeah, Michael Moriarty did the intro and spoke in a British accent for some reason, which was a little confusing.
He is
but,
a character.
Yeah, like he delivered the whole intro in a British accent, and I'm like, isn't he from New York? So yeah,
his character in Q is very special. It's it's truly one of those special characters.
He just goes into that that bar and just starts scatting.
Playing the piano.
And then in the stuff, he's Mo Rutherford, because every time I get money, I ask for Mo. You're just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, go search the Larry Cohen files. King Cohen. Good
King
stuff.
Cohen.
King Cohen. Yeah.
In the vein of documentaries, I just want to give a little plug to Wolfman's Got Nards. I had an opportunity to see it.
I still haven't gotten it.
I think I'm in that.
You are. You are. Yes, you have very smart things to say. You definitely tie it together.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I need to see it. I really can't wait to.
No, it's really good. Andre Gower, who is the star of Monster Squad, did this documentary with Henry McComas, and Andre directed it. Mm-hmm. Andre co-wrote it, and it is both a kind of history of the Monster Squad, how it began, shooting, and, you know, kind of like the kind of standard history of a film. But the stuff that really, really works is once the Monster Squad is kind of rediscovered. Now, the fandom never really went away, but I definitely feel like a light switch went on with the Monster Squad fandom.
Didn't happen with the Draft House?
It happened with the Draft House screening, and that is there. I mean, well, is it in there? There's so much footage.
I know Decker talks about
it
on
really, really
podcast
good.
With
Yeah, and Decker, you know, Decker's interviewed.
Yeah.
Everybody's interviewed. There's a lot of people.
Dude, he's got a Predator about to come out. How crazy is that?
I know. Let me just tell you, oh my God.
So the last Predator trailer got me so stoked.
I didn't get to see the last one. I'm going to wait. But man, I'm excited. I don't need to be sold on
the
Predator.
They look gorgeous.
I am so pumped. But Wolfman's Got Nards definitely has a lot of heart, a lot of smart. It's very amusing. There's a great moment when Andre is with a super fan who's got all of this, you know, Monster Squad paraphernalia and posters, and he rolls out the original poster campaign for the film, and it's these really dopey photographs of the mummy, Frankenstein's monster, Dracula, but they're not the ones represented in the films. They're just like random schmuck number 1, 2, and 3 dressed up like the famous monsters, but they're mugshots. And they all have like wanted for excessive drinking and, you know, all this sort of stuff. But on the top of the mummy poster, it's like wanted for statutory rap.
Oh, my God.
And it's just such a groan moment. But the great thing is the camera whip pans to Andre and he's just looking at the camera and shaking his head because it's just like it was that promotional campaign that really sealed like this is fate, this yeah. is yeah the seal of the film's fate because the film bombed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there are a lot of layers to the film that to the documentary that really work when it finally comes out. Please do check it out. It's on the festival circuit now, but it's fantastic. It's really, really well done, especially if you're a Monster Squad fan. And then one other thing I just want to throw in. I've watched – I revisited Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. The Wiederhorn.
We talked about that.
You talked about it two episodes ago. Nothing new to bring to the table other than it feels – going into it, you're kind of like, here we go. Settled in. More Return of the Living Dead. Yeah. And then you go, kind of over Return of the Living Dead right now because I love the first one so much. And and what's interesting about the humor in this film is that it relies on the humor of the first film mm-hmm. but doesn't take it further. And there's a perfect scene where this is exemplified where James Caron and Tom Matthews are doing the watch your tongue, boy, if you like this job. And he's like – and Tom Matthews goes, like this job. And then you expect the joke to go one further and like with something added.
Yeah.
And Tom Matthews just goes – like this job again. And you're like, oh, that's all you got, man.
Yeah, that's
all you got.
But I mean, that's the thing. I don't think of Wiederhorn in comedy at all.
No.
Like, I think, I like his Eyes of a Stranger and, you know, Shockwaves has its moments. But man, I don't think of him as fun.
No.
I don't think his films are fun.
No. Mm-hmm. And it was nice to see Mitch Pileggi pop up.
Yeah.
You know,
and it does have that great scene where the girl's going to eat the brains. That's the one thing I always think that's funny. It's like genuinely kind of funny.
You know, let me eat your brains.
That's genuinely funny.
And then finally she's just like, okay, fine.
Yeah. That's the one.
She has like this moment of orgasm.
Orgasm where she almost smiles.
Yeah.
And the cracking. I remember the skull cracking.
Oh, God. Yeah. Anyways, it's nice to have in the collection. I'll revisit it 10 years down the road just to go, oh, yeah, Return of the Dead 2.
Yeah.
Got it. You know.
Yeah.
I know.
He has not brought the fun back a little bit with 3, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not perfect, but it's fun. No one expect perfect from Yesna.
Becca, anything else?
That's all I got for the week.
All right. Well, let's bring on our two guests. Tonight's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Month of Myers pre-orders are now available through Sunday, September 9th. 5 of their shirt designs are up for pre-order, and while these and many others will be released in October, this is the best chance to guarantee in getting one. This includes new designs for the new film, guys. Also coming soon, Teen Wolf Collection, which features all new shirts and enamel pins, as well as the exclusive shirt and enamel pin for the documentary Haunters, which we're all familiar with, as are you, dear listener. Haunters, The Art of the Scare, is now streaming on Netflix. So head on over to www.fright-rags.com now, and you can enter the code SUMMERSHOCK10 at checkout and get 10% off your entire order. Again, that's SUMMERSHOCK10. So head to www.fright-rags.com now.
This week's Shockwaves is also sponsored by Wellgo USA. Coming soon from Wellgo USA, we have 3 amazing movies. First up is Gonjim. Based on local legends and stories of people who have visited the real-life abandoned hospital, Gonjim Haunted Asylum follows the crew of horror web show who plan to stream live from inside the asylum, but encounter much more than expected. On digital, Blu-ray, combo, and DVD September 18th. Wellgo USA also has Phantasm in a beautiful 4K scan. The tall man is back with a vengeance. Boy. And they also have, coming soon, Phantasm 3, Lord of the Dead, Phantasm 4, Oblivion, 2 cult classics in Don Coscarelli's legendary horror franchise, make their standalone Blu-ray debuts September 18th, and they look stunning. Check them out online at www.wellgousa.com.
This week's Shockwave is also sponsored by RLJ Entertainment. Find out what's really going on behind enemy lines in the gruesome thriller Trench 11, out now on DVD, VOD, and digital. A deadly disease created by German forces is on the loose and spreading fast. Will Lieutenant Burton be able to stop the outbreak and end the war? Find out in this dark World War horror. Gruesome Magazine calls it a cinematic thrill ride. Get Trench 11 on Amazon.com now.
Guys, Fangoria is back. Did you know this, Becca?
I did. I'm Elric, vaguely did you know familiar.
This? I did.
Resurrected just in time for this Halloween, the magazine that set the standard is coming back as a deluxe 100-page quarterly edition. Expect set visits, deep dives, new discoveries, fiction, and exclusive artwork. Specific content is being kept under wraps for now because Fangoria wants you to experience true analog nostalgia when you open that black poly bag and see what's inside for the very first time. But it's not just a magazine anymore. Fangoria is also bringing you novels under its Fangoria Presents label, and Fango is also getting into the movie biz. Be sure to check out their latest release, Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, out now. Head to Fangoria.com and subscribe to Fangoria. A subscription is $60 and will save you about $20 off the cover price. That's Fangoria.com. Subscribe now.
And a Phil Noble Jr. nude spread in the middle, apparently.
Is he dressed as James Bond?
I don't know. Yeah, apparently it is. It says Sean Connery. I'm
Fold
excited.
Out.
That's okay. Apparently what he's going for.
Phil, we can't wait.
I'm in.
Have you guys been listening to the new Blumhouse Podcast Fear Initiative?
I have.
Is it not fun?
It's a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun. The Blumhouse Podcast Network has just launched an all-new show. Blumhouse presents Fear Initiative, a weekly horror role-playing game podcast. Join Game Master David Ian McKendry as he takes players Morgan Peter Brown, Kara Mandel, Jeff Seidman, Megan Duffy, Rob Schraub, Josh Forbes, and Clark Wolf through a weekly journey of horror-inspired role-playing adventures. Creepy dolls, soulless killers, and bloodthirsty beasts. This RPG is scary as shit with occasional music numbers. Tune in every week and hear what new horrific quest awaits. Blumhouse's Fear Initiative is now available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and more. Please find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fear Initiative.
All right. So we've got two very special guests in the house. They're both visiting from Canada, the friendliest place on earth.
Part of the Commonwealth, which I also am part of, so I'm pleased as a New Zealander.
You know. I don't know what that means.
Oh, you don't know what the Commonwealth is?
It's the crown.
I think it means the queen owns
something
you.
Something like cool.
That's Andrea Subasati.
Yeah, yeah.
You can hear her speaking. Hello. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you.
We also got Gigi.
Hey,
what's up?
Hey.
Gigi, have you been on the show before?
No, man.
We tried a couple times.
Did I dream
that?
Yeah,
we tried. No, we tried to set it up a couple of times.
Yeah,
because you were here a couple of months ago, and I was like, let's get Gigi on, and then it didn't happen, and I don't remember why.
Okay. Gigi's the best.
We got her back now.
Filmmaker.
We did it.
Writer, director, video game creator.
Thank you.
Can I add that to the mix, too?
Yeah, of course.
Our single greatest export after Drake.
Andrea.
I love that.
Andrea, if you guys don't know, heads up Rumorg Magazine. You're the big boss lady.
Woo. Boss lady.
Also, co-host of the fantastic Faculty of Horror podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Many traffic hours here in Los Angeles.
Of which I'm sure there are many.
There are many.
Oh my gosh.
But you guys
do
killer work on a podcast.
That's, oh, thank you.
I love that. Yeah. I love
thank
that.
You kindly.
I need to get myself a t-shirt.
Wink, wink.
Yeah. But what are you guys in town for? You're here just visiting.
Yes.
Just for kicks. Gigi, you're here for work.
Yeah, man. Yeah. But we saw each other at Horrible Imaginings, which, by the way, if anyone has any short films or features, definitely send it their way. That festival was a lot of fun.
Yep.
And it was the first time they did it in Santa Ana. So from there, Andrew and I were like, I'm going to be in L.A. Me too. Let's hang. Totally.
Did you
and never
short...
not working, right?
No, that's a thing.
Never fully leisure. Like,
exactly.
We'll come for a film fest. We'll stay for a few meetings and wind up on Shockwaves.
Exactly.
Like you do.
We're the last stop for everybody.
Perfectly planned.
Rumorg is celebrating its 21st anniversary Halloween issue.
Can you believe it?
I can't. Because I remember the very first issue I picked up had Shadow of the Vampire on it.
Really?
Wow.
I was walking through the streets of New York looking for a new magazine to read, and there was Willem Dafoe as Nosferatu himself.
Aww.
And I said, what is this new magazine, and where does it hail from? And I was like, oh, cool, new voices and new fans. And I've been hooked since then. Andrea, when did you come on board, Rumorg?
I came on board, I guess technically it was about 5 years ago. I came on board as a copy editor, and I worked as copy editor for a bit, and then they needed a new office manager, so I did reception for a bit, and then what the heck, they needed a new editor.
From reception to editor, I like it.
Why look far, you know? Like,
the answer is right there.
May as well pick someone who knows how to pick up the phone.
Yeah. So take us through your daily duties. I mean, like, an editor of a magazine, of Canada's only horror magazine?
Yeah, I guess so.
And how often is that? Like bimonthly now?
We're bimonthly now. Yeah, we're bimonthly as of this time last year, which is tricky. You know, it has its challenges. Is we can't provide news.
Yeah,
you know, no. we can't be on the vanguard of what's new in hip hop happening. I have to look in my crystal ball. Like right now we're working on the November, December issue. So it's what are people going to be giving a shit about 2 months from now?
Post Halloween and Suspiria coming out, which is hard to imagine.
I get a press release and it's like, this is coming out a month from now. And I'm like, too late and not even yet. Yeah. So it doesn't make sense. But as a result, it's forced us to kind of redirect the magazine and kind of recalibrate what we want the magazine to be and what we want it to provide. Yeah. I don't actually think there's much point in being a news magazine. There's really no point in competing with the internet.
No.
If people are going to pick up Rumorgue, it's going to be because it's beautiful, because it's a collectible, because it provides some perspective and direction. And so,
and it also provides recipes.
The Homicidal Homemaker. I love
Homicidal Homemaker is my new favorite addition.
Have you guys met her?
Yeah, yes. She catered Etheria a couple of years ago. She may still be doing it, but she came wait, what's her name? Kara. I was getting ready to say Kara. But yeah, Casey came and she brought cupcakes to Etheria one year.
Okay, I do remember that.
And yeah, she's catered a couple of parties I've been at. I feel like she did Scream.
No, she's
Fest
great.
Once.
She's had tables over at Monsterpalooza or Midsummer Scream, but fantastic. I mean, it's stuff like that is evergreen and keeps the magazine going. You're right. I mean, like, everybody can get everything on Twitter and social media now. I feel like social media has kind of thrown horror websites into the past. I mean, like, you really have to struggle with fresh, unique content if you want to survive. I'm kind of glad that I got out when I did because, I mean, I would have just torn my head off if I had to compete with the onslaught of news that goes on Twitter and Facebook.
Right.
That's where primarily I get most of my news now, or, you know, alerts via email.
Yeah.
So it's I like sitting down on a weekend with a nice cup of coffee and just reading magazines every once in a while.
Yeah, you're not getting the news, but maybe you're reflecting on the news. Maybe you're digesting it in an interesting way. It's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Gigi, what are you up to? You're doing all sorts of cool stuff. You know what? You can't talk about this video game thing, but you can tease it. What do you got to tease?
Well, with the video game, well, that was a cool experience.
Yeah.
Like, that was
Who did you do it for?
It was for Capcom.
Okay.
They were looking for writers at the time that totally suit the genre that I'm interested in.
And what genre would that be?
Is that kind
Latino
of
Latino horror?
I was going to say, is this like more luchador or is this?
More like Latin horror. Okay. For sure. So
luchador?
Huh?
Let's invent a word. Yeah.
That should just be a genre.
You're gonna walk through the luchador.
That should just be a thing.
That's been one of your shirts with that, which I questioned why that didn't become a feature because it seems like it kicks ass and it should.
Soon.
Okay.
I'm not giving up on El Gigante for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Capcom they're doing this new game, this new reimagining of this game they already have. And it's taking this new direction. So it was kind of right place, right time. I auditioned for one of the supporting roles and got a call back.
That's awesome.
And, you know, they do the usual. They look on IMDb, what you've done. They're like, wait, this chick does this kind of stuff. And they were looking for writers at the same time. So they were like, do you want to do both? I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Like, I'll do it. So I did a contract of 6 months and totally learned really fast what it's like to write for a video game. It's very different. It's very different than film.
It's like choose your own adventure almost.
Yeah, yeah. You write hundreds and hundreds of pages because your audience is the player.
Yeah.
So they can change your storyline at any given time they want. So you got to be prepared for that. So that was really cool.
I mean, is the decision tree like mapped out on the page or on a giant whiteboard in terms of, okay, if they go through this door, if they do what, like
video game people are all about Excel spreadsheets.
Oh, wow.
I can tell you right now, I did not fit in. I was like, wow, like this is my worst enemy.
Is the game like an open world environment, something like Red Dead Redemption, where you can pretty much go through and respond and interact with everything?
Yeah.
Or is it kind of more like a Silent Hill where there's a set path with only a couple of different options?
It's more like that second one. But I mean, it all depends, right? Like in video game world, you never know what they'll decide. Mm-hmm. And it could just, at any time, they could go with a different story. So at this point, I'm just waiting to see if if the story will continue on, you know, and like my job was done and now they're designing whatever it is they chose. I don't know which script, but they're designing now and hopefully I'll hear back. I'll know when my character goes into act which script they chose. So that's when I'll find out more information.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Now, where can our listeners find some of your shorts?
Everything's on luchagoreproductions.com.
Uh-huh.
And definitely we have our bigger series, La Quinceañera, that we made with Stage 13 and Warner Brothers, and that will be announced soon where the release will be.
Okay.
Which platform. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Have you guys seen that?
Yeah.
I have.
Oh, you have?
A couple episodes? Okay.
No, just a couple episodes.
And
just
you
like
sent
a,
me, yeah. I think, a teaser. You sent me something that I watched. So
yeah. Just a little trailer. Yeah. You got to watch the whole thing, Ryan.
I know. Well, I was reserving my – I mean, like, it's really impressive. It's really cool. But
it's fantastic.
But I wanted to wait. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It gets wild.
I don't want to say too much on
it
air.
It gets wild.
Yeah.
Cool.
Can you at least give the plot setup for that?
Yeah, definitely. No, La Quinceañera, for those who don't know. La Quinceañera is a very special Mexican tradition when a 15-year-old girl turns 15. It's the night she's supposed to become a woman. But in our quinceañera, this one, it all goes wrong. So this family is planning their daughter's quinceañera, but little did the family know that the dad was making business deals with the cartel to make money, enough money to pay for the party. Deal goes wrong. Cartel comes and crashes the party. So it's up to La Quinceañera and her abuela, her grandma, to fight against the cartel. Awesome. In short words, Latino Kill Bill. I think that's the fastest way to put it.
So it's action-based mostly?
Mostly. Okay. But it definitely has a lot of genre elements. A coming-of-age horror, I would like to call it.
It's a radical departure from what
it
you
is.
Did with.
Yeah,
with,
it is.
El Gigante. I mean, that was like Luchador, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
With a little bit of Rob Zombie in there.
Yeah.
That's the one my favorite most.
What's the real
projects.
You? This project or El Gigante?
I think El Gigante. I'm really messed up. but I can tell you, like, Quinceañera was the first time my mom was able to watch the whole thing through. Yeah. So that was nice. She's like, ay, mija, this was better. You know, like, yeah.
Andrea, take us to the history of Faculty of Horror, which everybody should be listening to, by the way. We recommend this often.
Yeah, it comes up on the show a lot.
Yeah, when did you get started? Because I came in really late.
I was late to class.
Yeah.
It's going to be 6 years in January.
Wow.
I can't believe
that's
it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's how long we've been going.
But you guys have been going like what? Every week, right?
Yeah, we do.
Right, but we don't do a deep dive like you guys do. You
we
guys
do
actually
an
research.
Yeah.
We just
you
show
listen
up.
To this and we're just like
we so stumble our way.
I talked about a movie called Miss Leslie's Dolls at the top. That's where we are. So,
yeah. I love that.
So the genesis of it was I was a guest on the Rue Morgue podcast and Alex West heard it. And then Alex was a guest on the Rue Morgue podcast and she said, you know what? We should start a podcast. She's like, I've been listening to podcasts and there's nobody talking about horror the way we can talk about horror. And so let's just put it out there. And at worst case scenario, we will have a nice evening, you know? And so I took my USB mic that I used for Rock Band and I wrapped a sock around it so it wasn't too noisy when we were passing it back and forth, and we recorded it on my couch. I recorded it on Audacity, and I cut it and edited it. And
Audacity.
Yeah, good old Audacity. And then I made this, like, spit guard thing out of a coat hanger and some pantyhose. So it's just, like, footwear and hosiery figures prominently into our production values of the Faculty of Horror all the way along.
Ernie, this sounds like a step up.
Why don't we have wire hangers?
Just go to the hosiery department of Walmart and it has everything you need. And I mean, now we're at the Rue Morgue Manor. We're recording out of the vault. We have a bit better equipment, not as fancy as this, but a bit better. But yeah, 5 years later, you know, we're starting to make guest appearances. We're starting to travel a little bit, but it's been tremendous and it's been hugely rewarding just to have that perspective kind of acknowledged and people clearly respond to it. And I think that was a big part of my career. I think landing the gig at Rue Morgue was just like, I can prove that I have something to say that people want to hear. And there's perspectives out there that maybe audiences that aren't being addressed.
Mm-hmm. And deep dives. It's nice to hear analysis to actually settle into just a movie or a couple. I think you guys did the when you were doing like French Extremity movies, I believe, right when West her book was coming out, right?
That's right.
That series was really good.
Yeah, she has a new book out on 90s horror.
Yep.
Really?
Yes.
I finally finished it. Yeah. Like I knew it took me the summer just because I had a bunch of other shit going on, but I was very fulfilled. It was I messaged her and I was like, this is fantastic. Because I think that the 90s in general, I mean, the generation of horror fans who grew up in the 90s will disagree, but for my generation, 90s is often frowned upon. But there are a lot of great films that came out of that era. Mm-hmm. And I think the 90s teen horror craze that got kind of instigated prominently with Scream, but it was obviously kind of Kraft, Buffy, and My Boyfriend's Back kind of laid the groundwork. I think there's a lot of rich, cool stuff in there. And I think Alex really extracted all of that really kind of great critical thinking out of those films. I mean, there are some that feel like, okay, it doesn't explore the same space that Scream does, but at least it's trying to say something. Like The Crush. Like I had not.
Oh, Crush was big for me. I liked it a lot when I first
She made me want to see The Crush again. So. I mean, it's just like, wow. Yeah. I mean, like,
I was probably the same age as Alicia, so it doesn't sound as dirty as it feels now saying that, but we're probably both 15 when they came out.
I always really liked Cherry. Oh, I can't remember her name.
Cherry Falls.
Yeah. I always thought that one.
Well, Cherry Falls was like right on a cusp.
It was right on the cusp, yeah. But I liked that one as kind of a teen slasher, and it kind of got always polarized a little
bit. Well, that one's a lot weirder.
Yeah, it is.
I like weird. It subverted the final girl trope, right?
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite Gigi in the 90s?
I was born.
Yeah, I was going to say you're the 90s generation I'm talking about. So what were some of your favorite horror movies?
Well, definitely, I mean, it's funny cuz like for me growing up, especially in a Mexican house and Mexican household, for us we're very spiritual culture and very spiritual people. So I wasn't allowed to watch anything for my entire childhood, which made me more curious growing up.
Then what was the first?
Then the
what
first
was the thing
one,
that corrupted?
Yeah. Yeah, no. So I would love to walk down the Blockbuster aisle of horror and look at all the VHS covers, be like, oh my God, like which one, right? So I actually stole one when I was 8.
Which one?
Child's Play. Yeah, I stole because I just remember. I remember the visual of the doll with the big scissors. And for me, like as a kid, that was everything. I was like, what is that? I think I only got through maybe 20 minutes, turned it right off, and I was like, wow, a movie can make you feel like that. I got in trouble and everything. But a couple of years later, The Exorcist got remade, remastered, I think worldwide. It came out again.
Oh, yeah.
That would have been like
1999.
Yeah. So when that came out, I was like, Mama, I'm going to be a 2-digit number. I'm turning 10. I'm old enough. Yeah. I'm like, I want to see my first horror movie. That's all I asked for my birthday. My mom's like, okay, I've had enough of you. I'm going to take you, bring your little cousin too. And then you're going to shut up. So she took us.
Wait a minute. How old was your cousin?
My cousin must have been my age. We were back.
Oh, so you were both double digits.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, this poor kid. I mean, like.
Your 4-year-old cousin.
No. My mom just made sure to pick the one cousin that nobody liked in the family. Yeah. So, and I came out crying. And since then, like, was my first great experience. I loved feeling Linda Blair was following me. And that she was in my room. And I couldn't understand how a movie could do that to you. So, I mean, from there, I kept picking. But definitely those two, like, changed my life.
Yeah, we always say that people go on to become huge horror fans are always super scaredy cats when they first see horror.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It just fucking fucks them up so much.
Elric and I actually debated this at Horrible Imaginings because one of your bold horror statements was that you have to be forbidden to see
horror. No, I didn't say that. That's too bold. I just said I have so many friends,
I
wouldn't
hear this.
You went too bold.
So many friends I see on Instagram and stuff, they are showing all their kids all their favorite horror movies. And so all I was saying is like, hey, guys, this might backfire because you think you're making future horror fans by safely showing all your favorite movies, but no one showed most of us shit, and we had to go seek it out in a taboo fashion, and that's why it felt so alive, and then we were masters of our domain.
To
which not something
I disagreed
else.
With okay. because yeah. my parents were horror fans.
Yeah,
let me
no
watch whatever I wanted, and it just made me want to watch more.
Right. Remember, we said bold horror statements, not truthful.
Yeah.
There's no real. But it is interesting because I do see that a lot, like people trying to pass their interest on. Like, but with horror, man, there's something about discovery that was so rich and being scared and, and having to work through that fear yourself, not having anyone who could take it away. Like your parents can't take that away. You're alone at the end of the night.
I think, I mean, like as a stepdad now, you know, it's there are things that I won't show the kid.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, she's seen a lot of crazy
How
shit.
How old is she?
She's 14 now. Okay. And I'll probably show her The Exorcist this Halloween. Get ready. But that was like one of those things where it was just like, You gotta lay down the groundwork and go, I'm gonna show you these kind of gateway horror movies that got me into horror, but you can't watch this, and then plant
the hope
that
is
seed.
That they want that.
Plant
yeah.
that seed.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. But it is. It's just, you know, it's just one of those things you notice because our generation before us, for the most part, wasn't doing that, you know. And they couldn't stop it because the video stores is all on display. Like the way you saw it, it's just – that's the real discovery. That's why I don't know how you would discover – I mean, magazines are good. Fangoria was like that for when I was little.
Yeah.
But I don't know what that would be now for somebody – you know, Netflix is – those interfaces aren't the same. They're not – there's nothing aesthetic about that, I think. It's just like
– sanitized.
Route. Yeah. You know, you're just pushing a button.
Yeah, especially because I can, you know, since Marnie's only five. I mean, I have controls that I set about what pops up on her Netflix. So she actually has her own Netflix account that she can.
I can see Marnie finding some deep, dark shit on Netflix.
Especially your account.
No, she does not go into my account. Yeah. So she has her own account that she goes into, and it pops right up on the television, and I get to control. And anytime I see something that I'm like, I don't think she should be watching it yet, I can change it.
And we talked about skin in the game, like with VHS. If you rented it, you're going to watch the whole fucking thing. Doesn't
just
matter how bad that movie
it.
Is. You paid for it. You're the with Netflix, like 5 minutes
and
out.
That was
5 minutes out, you
my know. Bold horror statement was that Netflix is giving great voice to people who we previously may not have discovered, but at the same time, it's making lazy consumers because I am now the type of person who, if it doesn't entrance me in 15 minutes, I'm like moving on, whereas I never would have been that way before.
Yeah.
So,
it's because it's free. Netflix is free.
No, it just reminded me when he said the VHS, like the movie I really wanted in my teen years was The Faculty.
Oh, yeah.
And I got my VHS for that. And I was like, yeah, like that was one of my favorites growing up. And you know, we had to sit and watch the whole thing on my birthday party. It was like my first Canadian party. I was like my first Canadian friends.
What age was that?
I was my quinceañera.
Oh, so you became a woman in Canada.
So you moved from Mexico to Canada?
Yeah, right when I was turning that age. And I remember my parents got a lot of shit from all those parents that we watched The Faculty.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great, but
The food was great.
I've been to
three quinceañeras.
Oh, my neighborhood
just work friends.
We have quinceañeras every weekend.
I had a very lay low quinceañera because I didn't want one. I was too shy.
Oh wow!
Back then.
Oh my gosh! The girls in my neighborhood. I live in a very Hispanic area of Los Angeles, and they have like crazy quinceañeras,
crazy
wild
ones,
ball
right?
gowns and live bands and
those
mechanical horses that move around and you try to ride on top of them. That's it. There was one across the street because I tried it and I sucked, but it was a quinceañera.
So amazing.
Now growing up in Mexico, did you watch a lot of the traditional Mexican horror films like Alucarda or Poison for the Fairies or anything like
that?
Because I never get to talk about those on the show, so I'm kind of hoping the answer is yes.
Yeah, no, definitely. One of the first ones I started watching like once I wanted to go to film school and all that was Santa Sangre.
Mm-hmm.
I
don't know. That's one of my favorites.
That was one of the coolest. I just kept watching it over and over, and I wanted to be Conchita. I wanted to be this crazy woman that could just like control men like that. I don't know. Growing up, I was obsessed with her. So if I had to pick one, like it would be that one.
So last year at the Blumhouse Halloween party, because they have a Blumhouse Halloween party here.
I bet those are awesome.
Somebody dressed up as the minuet girl from Santa Sangre.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, you
said there were like five of us that understood what she was. And the cowboy, the girl that it was another girl that was with her dressed up as the cowboy.
That's amazing.
And I was so excited. And I don't
that's
think
impressive.
A lot of people recognized it.
That's
but, good. It was a really cool costume.
That's awesome.
I was going to ask Andrew, what got you into horror?
Oh boy!
Let's get back into your roots. I want to know this.
Oh boy! I wish I had a really great story. It was books. It was literature first and foremost.
Books.
Yeah. I didn't have
that's
access.
A different podcast.
I didn't have access to the movie, so it was it was R.L. Stein, and then you graduate up to Stephen King. Yeah. And I remember I went to Catholic high school, so like there wasn't very scary stuff in my school library, and I had to have my mom write a note to my local librarian to allow me to take out proper Stephen King books, even though I was like underage. Like these were like restricted books. And so from there, it was like I moved on to Stephen King adaptations of films. I felt like those were safe because I knew the stories, and The Shining just fucked my shit up.
Because then you realized the book was not much like the movie.
Well, I realized how powerful the movie could be. And like even when it made a great departure.
Sure.
From the book, the departure could be very meaningful, and that was very powerful for me. So, that was one of the early ones, and then I kind of really amassed a lot of cinematic adaptations of literature, like A Clockwork Orange, all the Stephen King books. I met Mick Garris for the first time yesterday, and I was like, "Hi, you did some of them right, some of them not so much." But we had a great chat, So I feel like that was really my gateway.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What was the takeaway from R.L. Stein just as a kid? Because that was something that was – I had already moved past all of that.
What?
I didn't, it came after my time. It was after my time.
Now that was like peak for me.
I had no.
Wow, you're really aging Turk away from yourself nicely there.
No, and that's weird because you're only a couple of years.
But I'm curious. Like as a kid, what did you gravitate to with the R.L. Stein? Was just the kitschy concepts or was there actual genuine fear?
I'm talking about like Fear Street. I'm not talking about Goosebumps.
Fear Street, Christopher Pike was totally my jam. A little bit of Lois Duncan.
So it was teenage. It was almost like slasher literature, you know? And then it moved on from there. And I ate up Goosebumps later as it came out. But I was at a store today that on Magnolia.
Halloween Town.
Halloween Town we went to, but also a comic book shop that had all the old
Black
Goosebumps.
Cat.
And I was just stuff them in my cheeks.
Did you? Because you said you went to Catholic school. Did they ever restrict like students? I don't know. Like already, that's like eerie, no?
It made the religious stuff so taboo, right?
For sure.
Blew my wheels because it was
because that's the stuff
shit.
That I grew up with too.
Yeah,
being Catholic. Too.
My daughter's in Catholic school now because we like the curriculum, and I'm just kind of like, meh. She'll she gets different stuff at home, so I'm
the
like,
dress
codes. Yeah, the dress code. I'm like, I don't have to buy clothes. It's pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, like maybe hers is liberal, but I mean, they so far have been like, oh, you make horror films. Come do a horror day at school. We'd love to have you tell horror stories to the students. And so I'm actually going in Halloween and doing that.
Amazing.
So that's great. Hers is a little bit, but that's Los Angeles Catholic school. Maybe it's a bit more liberal.
Yeah.
But. Yeah.
What is that Netflix series? The Innocence or whatever? The thing with the priest?
I haven't seen it yet.
It's terrifying. Wow. Yeah. It's one of the most disturbing true stories I've heard in a long time. What was that show called? The Keepers.
The Keepers. Yeah.
Is it based off that?
No. This is the actual documentary series that they put on it. The Keepers.
It's
frightening.
So
I found that more disturbing.
The Innocence.
No, it's a totally different thing. But I thought it was more disturbing than Spotlight, to be honest. Because it's just, I don't know, what people can get away with under the guise of organized religion and structure, power structures, is always a little more disturbing. So.
More disturbing than Evil Genius?
Evil Genius was crazy.
That is just bananas.
And what was the one about the cult in Oregon?
Yes,
that was another
really
one
good.
That like disturbed. It was the Duplass Brothers.
Wild Country. That's one of those things where you're watching a thing about Colin. You're like, this isn't so bad. And then they just show one little insert of what was actually happening in the therapy sections, and you were just like, oh fuck, because it was like abuse. I mean, it was nudity and people smashing each other's heads in, and you're like, oh fuck, okay, I'm out.
Yeah, because I spent the first part of that documentary going, well, what's the deal? They look happy. Yeah. Leave them alone. So what? They're all wearing the same shirt. Good for them. They're happy. and then it goes
intense.
Nudity, beating, and it's just like, oh my god!
But there's only that little bit in the whole thing. I guess it's hard to get that footage, but it's crazy stuff. How do we get to cults?
Speaking of cults, like I've always been interested in the story, but like I've been trying to get the story out of my mom, but my mom and her brother, so my uncle, when they were young teens, they were lying to my grandma that they were going to an after school music program in Mexico City, when really they were going to a cult.
What?
Yeah.
How old were they?
My mom's gangster. It's crazy. She would steal holy water from church because things got fucked up.
For protection?
So like protection.
So my mom must have been 13 and then my uncle around 17.
And what cult was? I mean, what cult was this?
She won't tell me. But like really? She, you can see in her arms, like she gets goosebumps trying to talk to me. And
so you're gonna say she like carves symbols.
Oh yeah, yeah.
She hides them with sleeves. Yeah,
yeah. No, and so yeah. Speaking of cults, like, and I can see it through her. She can't barely talk about it, and they got kicked out of it because my uncle and my mom fucked around too much with what they can do. Yeah. Like it was like mediums and shit. And wow. So they had to get cleansed.
So a cult.
Yeah. Yeah. So they had to get cleansed with the gypsies in Mexico City because things just went horribly wrong. Huh. And I think that's why, like, my mom was like, no to everything violent, to everything, my whole childhood. sorry, mom.
Yeah.
But, like, it's pretty wild. Like, that still today she won't tell me much about it.
Wow.
Slowly but surely, like I've seen, and
so we'll all tweet at her and get this full story for
you.
Yeah, there's a lot of crazy stuff.
Yeah, it does sound like
that. Yeah, and they warned my mom when she was pregnant with my sister, the gypsies, because she was following very specific rules. Like, you had to put specific type of flowers in one corner of the house. You had to put specific kind of rocks and coal in another corner. Like, you had to do very specific things for things to go away.
Now, when you're saying gypsies, is this more like spiritual mediums?
I think so.
Okay, yeah.
We call them gypsies.
But that's European. It's completely different.
Yeah, bad gypsy movie.
But yeah, pregnant with my sister, my mom kept going back, and they warned her that possibly if she was to have another child, to be very careful, because I could possibly be very sensitive to any of that stuff.
Ooh.
So my mom had to follow the rules exact, but she didn't. She fucked up one more time with my uncle, and sure enough, something really scary happened. Like when I was a kid. But
wow.
Well, no one ever talks about horror films as audiences and the power of belief. Like so,
right.
The idea that you guys both growing up in Catholic cultures, and the fact that horror is so hugely popular in Hispanic culture now. Like, that's saying that I don't think people really maybe realized in LA until Universal Studios started having the haunts, at a certain point, you're like, wow. And I think the big part of that makes sense to me, because seeing The Exorcist from the viewpoint of believing in God, if you actually believe there's a God and you believe there's a devil and there's a soul to be dead, I can't imagine what that experience of watching something like that for the first time is versus I come from New Zealand, which is like the country that probably has the least religion on earth. It's just very, no one seems to believe in much. And yet you can still be scared of something, but it's not the same. If you actually believe in these things.
I don't know that it came from a place of believing in these things more so than this was something that you did at school. And this was something you did on Sunday morning, and you wore your very best dress and you wore your nice white socks that you didn't wear ever any other time. And so it was something that was sacred. It was something that was sacrosanct.
Right.
And so to see something that was violent and, like she pisses on the floor and she vomits across the room.
Yeah.
To see something so ugly and dirty associated with something that is so holy. I think that was the dichotomy more so than fucking with a fairy tale that you find.
Yeah, but for somebody it must be, right? Like there must be some people who truly, like really just completely believe, and then they see a movie like that. I almost wish I could live in that shoes to experience what a horror film could do.
But you're right. Like for me, I believe in that stuff. And funny enough, none of the things I've made touch on religion, ghosts, demons. Because honestly, I feel I'm going to fuck up and something's going to haunt the set. Like I'm terrified. Yeah. But I do see what you mean though at the same time.
Well, we talked about that was another one of the bold horror statements that we discussed. I think we just discussed it. It wasn't a statement exactly. How Exorcist is really powerful for some people. But for me growing up, my family was completely devoid of religion. Like my mom was an ex-hippie. My dad just never was into it. So we literally never went to church. And so the first time I saw The Exorcist, I was just like, I don't get it. It's a girl tied to a bed. I don't get it. Did not like, and I've said that for me, Exorcist 3 was my jam because that one was scary. Whereas the first Exorcist, I was like, it's moody, but I didn't even get later I realized what a well-made film it was. But when I was 14 watching it for the first time, I wasn't scared.
Remotely. Exorcist 3? So the thing with Exorcist 3 that I think works really well is because it kind of steps back from the religion and stuff because it becomes
procedural.
More grounded. It's procedural. There's a human threat out there that's doing very vile things to, tarnishing the statue in that church and then – extracting all of this blood and putting it in very specific vials. That, I mean, someone who has the kind of precision and patience to do something like that has got to be absolutely insane. And that's what scared me more than a possessed Brad Dourif, you know?
Yeah. No, and Exorcist 3, and I mean, now it's definitely flopped a little bit, but when I was 14 watching both of them, I would have said 3 is far scarier than 1. So, yeah.
Well, then it's weird to think, the flip side, I guess, of this argument is it's weird to think that people were scared of something they don't believe in. It's weird that you'd go to a movie called The Exorcist in the 70s watching somebody, you know, put the devil out of someone if you didn't believe it all and you're just watching this movie. Why would that be scary besides the aesthetics of a story getting tied in? Because I know for me, the only horror films that really kind of still give me a little chill tend to be ghost stories. And it's because I don't know. I have no idea what happens after life. No one does. And so I feel like there's still that little bit of an in, whereas werewolf vampires, it's like, yes, no, I'm pretty certain how I view these things. But ghost stories always can, even the Paranormal Activity, even like the final one, even if it's not any good, it can just unnerve me a bit, especially if you watch it at home where all the same kind of items are and just that kind of vibe. So I just think it's interesting. I never hear people really discuss like I'd almost like to listen to a podcast of two people who are, you know, very devout but talking about their experience to horror films. I'd be curious.
They're out there, yeah. There's theologist horror fans for sure. For me, when it comes to the original Exorcist, I actually find it much scarier watching it now than I did as a kid. And I think that's just because I've become an older woman and now I relate more to the mother.
Yeah.
And here we've got a woman who is desperate to save her child. She doesn't understand what's wrong with it. Medicine can't help her. And she has to go into this realm that she doesn't believe. She's not a religious woman, but she is so desperate that she's like, fuck it, if it helps, give it. Yeah. And to me, that's what's really terrifying because, again, that like it harkens back to a reality that I understand, which is to not be believed and to be maybe like – maybe it's mental illness. Maybe it's something that medicine hasn't quite acknowledged yet. It doesn't make it any less real and it doesn't make it any less terrifying.
Yeah. That's well put.
Sorry.
No, not at all. No, I mean, like,
and we watch down the room.
That's what happens with faculty at heart. We start thinking. Yeah. You make us think.
Alex, well, that is one of the things that got uncomfortable giggles when I saw that the Exorcist director's cut you've never seen, when they re-released it in 2000.
Yeah.
I saw it at the Chinese theater. And while it was probably filled with a lot of jaded audience members who have by the year 2000 seen quite a bit of, you know, horror, what came in the 90s and 80s and all that stuff. When all of the medical stuff came up, when it came to, let's put her on this, let's put her in another CAT scan, let's do this, there was a lot of uncomfortable giggles because everybody was just like, oh my God, this is awful. Nobody, they don't do this today. Oh, yeah. It was like, oh yeah.
And a lot of those tests hurt. They show her suffering.
Yeah.
Spinal tap, yeah.
What's the future of the magazine, Andrea? I'm curious as to in terms of bold horror
big
questions.
World
I'm
domination.
Just curious. I mean, like your
fame and fortune.
I've seen the operation. The operation's very impressive. I love that you're very committed to the point.
That was
so
nice that you came to visit.
Of course. You guys gave me a nice welcome. It was nothing like sitting back on the Rue Morgue porch drinking lemonade and beer.
With a Pomeranian in
there. I love that dog.
There's
so
always
much.
A
you
Pomeranian.
Met the Pom?
Oh, yeah.
He actually met Snacks.
I met Snacks.
Yes.
I haven't met the new one, Dante. Oh,
Dante is the current
the
Pom.
Needy,
of the
needy dog. That's my takeaway from the stories, the Instagram stories. But, you know, I mean, it's awesome to see the evolution of the magazine. And, you know, I've lived through multiple editors at Fangoria and seeing the magazine shift. And I feel like Rue Morgue is now going in an exciting new direction because of what we talked about earlier, which is less news, more original content. But for you, what do you want to do with it now?
I'm just trying to amass all the diverse voices that aren't being heard. And I think a lot of them aren't pitching to me.
Yeah.
Is the fact that when I used to criticize the magazine prior, when I used to criticize other magazines for being so white male, they'd be like, well, chicks aren't pitching. People of color aren't pitching. Queer people aren't pitching. And so what I'm trying to do, and it's a slow process, is to really foster an environment where people feel like they can pitch something that's totally off the wall. And also to try and learn like within the parameters of the magazine that no doesn't mean your idea sucks and that you suck and you're not a good writer. Like sometimes it just has to do with fitting into the magazine. So there's quite a bit of diplomacy involved in the gig. And so I'm trying to kind of amass a stable of writers that I can tap to make it what I want. And it's a process.
And how does one, say a listener is tuning into this episode and is like, I've got a voice and I would like to be heard and I've got an angle. Yeah. How do they reach out to you?
God, please email me. Please email me. And God damn it, don't get mad if I don't email you back right away. I get so many emails and I look at them all and I consider them all. So what you want to do is you want to tell me what you have to say, but you want to justify what you have to say. You can't just say, I get a lot of pitches that are like, I really love Nightmare on Elm Street 3. I grew up with it. It means a lot to me. That's great. And that's powerful. And that's a fantastic blog post that I will absolutely read. But if you're going to put it in the magazine, if I'm going to put it in the magazine, I need a little bit, like, what do you have to say about it? Why is it so important? Does it speak to something that was happening at that time? Is to kind of take a step back and take a macro view. That's what really turns my crank.
Yeah.
So by all means, pitch. And if something doesn't fit in the new issue, maybe it'll fit in a later issue. You know, it's not always immediate. With only 6 issues a year, sometimes it has more to do with fit than anything else.
And what is Rue Morgue's involvement in the convention scene? I mean, you guys still have the one up in Canada. It's no longer Fan Expo, which is quite honestly the last Canadian convention I had ever attended.
Is that right?
It is.
How long ago
it's
was been that?
It was a long time ago. Yeah, it was probably when I got this tattoo. It's when they were just like handing out tattoos. But now what is the Rue Morgue? What's the Rue Morgue convention? Is it during the summer or?
We have a convention coming up. We've joined forces with Frightmare in the Falls.
Oh.
Which is going to be at the end of October. So that's in Niagara Falls, Canada. And we've assigned a couple of guests and we've put together a couple of great panels. So that's
what's it
the
called?
First
is
time.
It's
Frightmare in the Falls.
Oh, Frightmare, yep. Okay.
Not so.
Frightmare in the Falls.
Mm-hmm. So that's going to be wicked cool. Faculty of Horror, we're going to be at Salem Horror Fest.
Oh, yeah.
Which is I'm going to see you there, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Am I though?
You're coming a weekend after me, I think.
Yeah, but
you're not going to be there the whole
thing? Not the whole thing, alas. You are the keynote speaker to the opening weekend. Yeah. I might just miss you.
Yeah, bummer.
But that's a great fest, and he's got Kevin is amazing.
Wait.
He's got a lot of great stuff planned, so we're really looking forward to that.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Are you guys doing a full show?
We are doing a live show, which we did last year for the very first time.
Yeah.
And normally our show is very heavily edited. And we've got our notes, and we're giving each other like gang signs and stuff to be like, I'm going to say something. Wait, you're mowing my lawn. You know, like we've got all this extra sensory communication happening. But when we're live, we can't. What?
Shockwaves could use some of that.
Yeah, yeah. We don't have any of that.
We can use some of those, like.
Yeah, we just do this.
I like
you're talking. I'm just going to talk.
You need a list. You need a list, guys. You need a list of pantyhose.
We're getting tips from faculty.
Like we do notes, but I'd say that's about it. Yeah. And sometimes we don't even do that. I always have notes.
I know.
I want to know. If there's a favorite Canadian horror film or something that people here might know lesser, or just one that you love.
My favorite Canadian horror film, and it's funny because this came up in Santa Ana when we were talking about Horrible Imaginings. Like, what film would you love to see re-released? And it's a film called Pin.
We've talked about Pin a lot.
I love Pin.
I'm so happy to hear that because so many people don't know about it. I don't understand why it hasn't been re-released because it is absolutely brilliant. And especially in the current context of understanding mental illness, it was way ahead of its time in terms of the sensitivity it portrays. And it's such a great story and it's brilliantly portrayed. And
it has
Tara really
Quinn,
think it's a gem.
You know, who's...
Yeah.
And he's Canadian. He has to be, right? Because he was also stepfather was shot in Canada, I think. So
I
have to
so.
Assume he's Canadian. I don't know. Yeah, that's a great film. Paul Korup, the guy who runs the Canexploitation.
It's actually Korup.
Oh, is it Korup? So I did a projection booth with him on that title. And so it was super fun.
He is the best.
Yeah, he's really
He is
great.
Incredibly
And it's a great website,
brilliant.
Too.
And we are so – I'm so – lucky to have him for the magazine. I actually feel like his column is maybe a little bit overlooked because, you know, he's quiet. He doesn't take the hot take. He's not flashy, but he is so, so smart. And so when I became editor, we rebranded his column to be Files from the Black Museum. And sometimes I wonder if it's very apparent what it is he's trying to do with his column. But what he tries to do with his column is to take a film and almost treat it as an artifact and just kind of really display how it continues to resonate in modern culture, and he like applies it to modern culture, and it's such a great column, and he's a fantastic writer.
I didn't even realize he had that with you, so this is good. I just learned.
Gigi, what are you up to next?
Well, we are starting to kick off season 2 of La Quinceañera, so hoping that that will go somewhere. And then we actually just got some partial funding for my first Luchagor feature. So still in the search for the rest. This is news I got last night.
Oh.
So this is you guys are the first to know.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I mean, it's in the works. It's just that Luchagor, we're trying to just go bigger now. We're trying a new hashtag, no more shorts. I have 18 of them. So I want to go bigger now. And hopefully here in LA with La Quinceañera will help get my foot in the door a little bit more. And yeah, just, you know, dream big and work hard.
And is there, I mean, like, this is just because you're really awesome and you're cool to hang out with. I mean, like, are you, what is holding you back from making that leap from Vancouver to LA? You know, I mean, like, obviously the flight's fine. So you can,
yeah, I feel like
everybody in LA, the goal is to live anywhere but Los Angeles.
Yes, yeah, yes,
and
it
be
is.
Able to work from afar.
And I hear this all the time. And yeah. I hear this.
Oh my
all
gosh.
The time.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a one writer I know, and he wrote a bunch of big horror movies, and now he lives in Seattle. He's just like, yeah, man, I'm doing good.
Yeah,
and
I know people who live in Northern California, and I'm like, you are so lucky. Just fly down.
Yeah.
One of our friends lives on the East Coast now. He just comes out whenever his films get produced. Yeah. And I'm just
Kelly
like,
Reichardt, the director, she said, Los Angeles is a great place to graduate from. And that always stuck with me. You need to do your time, and then you can go where the fuck you want once you got the degree. Yeah.
But you know what? Like, it's funny you say that because I do hear this all the time. Like, how come? But you know what? With the experience with Warner Brothers for La Quinceañera, the flying back and forth, it wasn't that bad.
Right.
Like it's a short flight. It's not that expensive.
Sure.
I've made enough friends to have a few couches to choose from.
Do you put a lot of value into carving off this like little nook of Canada to kind of create this horror empire, you know?
Yeah. And you know what? I just don't see moving yet because it's been really nice to share with my fellow Canadian crew the culture of the Latino horror. Like,
for
it's
sure,
been
yeah.
really nice to kind of make Luchagor grow over there. And it's all pretty new still. Like, we're still a new team. So there's still endless possibilities. I mean, I could end up here, but there's no answer of me like saying there's nothing stopping me though.
Right.
It's just seeing where life's going to go.
who's part of the Luchagor team?
I mean, you have a producer that I've met before.
Yeah. We're three core members.
Okay.
It's Rainer Shima who produces, and then Luke Bramley who's our cinematographer and sometimes co-editor, and then we work a lot with Shane McKenzie who's an amazing horror novelist if you haven't checked out his books.
Cool.
And then
met Shane. His stuff is crazy.
He's the one who wrote El Gigante, right?
Like, yeah, yeah, so it's based off his book, and we've been working with him on every project since. And then of course we have the same like crew on set over in Vancouver. So it's been nice. It's like a small little production company. Like, we rent out our gear now. Like, we're like, oh, we're more legit now, guys. Like, so we have a little business now going on. So it's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. All right, both of you, what's the one horror film this year that has impressed you the most?
Oh, shit.
Well, for me.
So far.
So I'd have to say so far this year, Hereditary, for sure. Yeah. It was my turn to choose. In my family, we take turns who chooses the movie night. And I didn't tell my parents what this one was about.
Oh, Jesus.
So I was like, oh, let's see Hereditary.
God.
Yeah, yeah. So I took him. My mom nearly died the whole film. But my dad, it's the first time I saw my dad scared, to be fully honest with you. And
it feels like it'd be scary. I don't know. For some reason, it's scary to adults
than
kids.
No, it's totally.
That's such an adult horror.
No, it's an adult horror film, straight up.
We talked about it, my dad and I. And I don't really talk with him about horror ever. And talking about it was like, and doesn't give anything away. But if you take out the horror out of the film, it's really about a dysfunctional family.
Yeah. It's a Bergman movie.
Yeah, so my dad really related to the characters. And that movie was badass. Like, definitely go see it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it just came out on Blu-ray.
I think my vote would have to go to Assassination Nation, which I was able to catch a little bit early and is featured in the September, October issue of RoomWorld magazine on stand September 1st.
I think I saw a poster for it.
There's posters.
Is it talking about Heathers and something?
Yeah. Heathers in the Purge.
Heathers in the Purge. Okay, I did see that poster.
Ad. I think I likened it to Heathers, but also Tragedy Girls. Kind of have that. But it's got this really poignant allegory that is so defensive of millennial culture, which of course, like the sociologist in me, like it turns my crank because I see a lot of people being like, oh, the millennials, these egomaniacs, these social media addicts. And I'm like, well, you know, that's not really a reality that they chose. That's something that that they're enduring and surviving and creating as they go along. And I consider myself – I'm kind of on the upper edge of what is considered a millennial. Mm. If you watch that Netflix special, I'm a millennial elder. So I'm a little bit defensive of that generation, and I feel like this film really speaks to that reality and the horror inherent in living online and living electronically and all the perils associated therein.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah. Is it funny?
Like it
Heathers?
Is funny.
Okay, it is funny.
It's
definitely
funny. I mean, I think like the first three quarters of it deals in like the vacuousness of this social media existence. But when shit hits the fan, it gets really real.
Okay.
Cool. Nice. Shit.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in.
All right. Well, Gigi, Andrea, thank you so
thank
much
you
for coming.
Thank you guys.
Thank you
so
much for joining us.
Thanks for making us your last stop in Los Angeles.
No.
Glad I want to have a Faculty of Horror Shockwaves true crossover episode one day.
Yeah. Okay.
Once
so
you're both.
As soon as you guys all get to LA.
Yeah. No, that'd be like, and Rob's missing. So we have two people missing. So
yeah.
One day.
I've seen the recording space.
You have.
It's very claustrophobic.
It's small.
Well, they can come here.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have more mics.
Or we can meet at a convention.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Actually, that's a good idea. A convention would be fun.
Very cool.
We'll figure it out.
I would love that.
We'll figure it out.
Cool.
All right, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.